I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The book is called Something Fierce, Memoirs of a Revolutionary Daughter. It is a new first book from the playwright and actor Carmen Aguirre, who joins me now. What she's written is a fascinating memoir about fleeing the Pinochet dictatorship in Chile in 1973, coming to Canada, and going back in the late 1970s. Her mother and stepfather were members of the Chilean resistance, and as they maintained their own safe house in Bolivia for members of the resistance, at the age of 18, she joined herself. The book is often dramatic, but it's also sometimes funny. It's a great view onto a part of the world that's often unreported or unremembered. This memoir, first from this perspective, is necessary, charming, and gripping. Carmen Aguirre has written or co-written 18 plays, including The Refugee Hotel, which was nominated for a Dora Maver Moore Award for Best New Play last year. Something Fierce is published by Douglas and McIntyre. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, Carmen Aguirre. Good morning, Ms. Aguirre.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. Now, as I mentioned in the intro, is this the first book in the about or by someone in the Chilean resistance?
As far as I can tell, I think it's the first book in English.
Yeah.
There are books in Spanish. The books that are out there in Spanish about being in the Chilean resistance are usually not in the first person, so they are written by ex-resistance members who speak of the organization or the movement as opposed to the first person. And most of the books that I could find in Spanish about the Chilean resistance were more political documents or political analysis of the situation as opposed to personal memoir of what it's like to be in an underground movement.
So you and your sister, you were born in Chile, is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Now, your parents, were they always leftists?
Yes.
Yeah. How old were you when Pinochet took over in 1974? 73, I guess, right?
Yeah, 73. I was 5 years old.
Yeah. And how soon after that did you all flee?
Let's think. 3 months after the coup, yeah.
Do you remember what it was like, I guess, before Pinochet? What Chile was like?
Yes, I do have memories, which, of course, I thought were completely normal. I didn't realize that being in a state of euphoria was not normal.
Mm-hmm.
So basically there was a state of euphoria during the Allende government. Certainly for the working class it was a state of euphoria. And my parents, being university teachers and having joined the student movement in the 60s, were so euphoric, again, to use the same word, during the Allende government, and our house reflected that. So our house was a house where that was full of people, late-night meetings and talks and planning. We lived in the south of Chile in Patagonia, and my parents took part in the literacy campaign. There was also an agrarian reform. All of this, of course, under the socialist government of Allende, who was democratically elected. So, yeah, I just have a very strong memory of the sensation of euphoria before the coup happened.
And then at the time of the coup, I mean, the memory changes, obviously, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Yeah, and so what was, I mean, do you remember part of the 3 months that you were there, you know, just
yes.
After they take over?
Yes, I remember the day of the coup itself because I remember I got up and I was surprised that nobody was getting me ready for school or waking me up to go to school. And then I could hear the radio coming from my parents' room, which again was surprising. It was quite early in the morning. And I could hear my parents weeping. So I went into their room, and we listened to Allende's final speech on the day of the coup, which he did from the presidential palace in Santiago. And, yeah, that memory is probably one of the strongest memory I have of that time. Then, of course, the house being empty as opposed to full, because many of my parents' friends were imprisoned or in hiding or had to flee or had been killed, and being kicked out of school because my parents were accused of being leftists, and so we were kicked out of school. The neighborhood changing completely. I remember the neighbor, it's the actual neighbor, declaring that they were pro-Pinochet, so that was a problem. Anyway, lots and lots of images as opposed to chronological memories of that time.
And so the decision to flee, I mean, it seems obvious now. Was that something that I mean, they never told you, I guess, or did they?
I don't remember. Yeah. I mean, all I remember is a dark night and kind of stopping off at people's houses and saying goodbye very quietly. I don't remember getting from Patagonia to Santiago, but I do remember the airport, because the airport was a very tense place during those days, full of people trying to get out, lots of military in the airport, lots of terror in the airport. So that's the next memory I have in terms of the actual leaving of the country.
So from Santiago, you went where?
Well, there's a huge, long backstory as to how we got to Canada,
yeah,
which was in the book in an earlier draft, but the book would probably have been about 600 pages long if we hadn't edited it a lot.
Yeah.
So I could get into the huge, long backstory. It would take a very long time. But it took us about 9 months from the time we left, I suppose, to actually arrive in Vancouver.
And why Vancouver? I mean, why Canada?
Two reasons. One is that Canada was one of the first countries to offer asylum to Chilean refugees. And the other one is that because of that, my uncle, who had been arrested in Valparaiso, Chile, after the coup, had just arrived in Vancouver as a political refugee. So those were the two reasons.
What were some of the earliest memories of Vancouver?
That it was very cold and gray and boring and nobody on the streets and no signs of life.
Yeah.
Those are the earliest memories, yeah.
Now, your parents' marriage, that didn't survive, and you write in the book that was, I guess, that happened a lot once you left, coming to a new place, the strains of that affect the marriage, right?
Yeah, it was quite common. Lots of marriages broke up in the 70s because of exile, because of the stress of what everybody had gone through.
And in the book, in the beginning of the book, we meet Bob, mm-hmm. Your stepfather. How soon after coming to Vancouver did your mom meet Bob?
We met Bob immediately because he was the first Canadian to come and greet us. Basically, we were all put up at what we would call the refugee hotel, which I don't know if it still is being used as this or not, but at that time it was the English Bay Apartment Hotel. So that's where the government would put you up when you first arrived, and while they figured out where to place you in terms of housing and work and all of that. And Bob, who was a Canadian guy who had been in Chile during the coup and had been arrested and put in the concentration camp that was the National Stadium in Santiago, had come back after he was released from jail in Chile. And it's thanks to him and an organization of people here, people getting organized here, that did a cross-country caravan to Ottawa and set up tents on Parliament Hill and said they would not move until Trudeau opened the doors to Chilean refugees. And so it's thanks to that movement of Canadians that did that, that we all came here. And because we were one of the first families to arrive, he came to the refugee hotel to greet us all when we first got here.
The relationship with Bob, between you and your sister, that was quite close, right?
Yes.
Yeah. You're in Vancouver how many years before you all decide to go back? I guess your mom and Bob decide to go back, and you're along for the trip, I guess.
Yes. So we went back to South America in 1979.
Yeah. Did you realize at all while you were growing up that your childhood perhaps wasn't normal? I mean, that sounds crass, but you talk in the book about. There's a moment in the book that I still remember after reading it a few days ago, was you were in an airport, I think, and you hear a voice, and it reminds you of Julie from The Love Boat.
Yeah.
That's a very different life than that which you lived. Did you realize that there was something out there that you wanted perhaps more for yourself?
No, I was very happy as a child. I was very, very happy to have a double life. I felt that I did have a double life growing up in Vancouver, like many, 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 many immigrant children felt and still do feel in this country. So the double life was, one was the home life, which in my case was Chile, was the solidarity movement. And the other one was the school life, where one did not talk about certain things because one would be considered crazy or a pathological liar. And I think a vast number of people in this country can certainly relate to that. So again, yes, TV shows tell us what a normal life is. Well, I don't know that anybody actually lives the life that the character of Julie lived on The Love Boat. But we all, especially when we're children, fantasize about that for sure.
Yeah, did you want something else for you and your family?
No, because it was all I knew, and I was very happy with having these two very rich lives. I was very happy with my school life and my quote-unquote Canadian life, and I was also very happy with the Chilean community life. It felt very full.
Yeah. So I've read about this book in other places online and in articles elsewhere, so I sort of know what happens. I'm reading the book at the moment, and I don't want to give it away because the way you write it makes you want to read it, and I just can't wait to finish the book. I'm sort of dancing around certain issues here because I think people should read the book for what's in it. Was there reticence on your part to talk about things that you talk about in this book?
Yes, and I think that's the main reason why nobody's written a book like this yet. I think it would be a little easier in terms of security mm-hmm. to write the book if I had belonged to the Sandinista movement, which won, and now there is a Sandinista government in Nicaragua, or if I had belonged to the African National Congress, which won and is renowned around the world. So you see where I'm going with this. Mm. I'm writing about a movement that lost, and it lost very badly. When I say that, what I mean is that inside Chile right now, there is the same constitution that Pinochet put in place in 1980. And that constitution has pages and pages and pages of quote-unquote anti-terrorism laws, which are currently being used in Chile against the First Nations people who are battling with their land claim issues and environmental issues. Even now, as we speak, there is a hunger strike being staged in Chile by members of the Mapuche Nation because they are being charged with terrorism because they were fighting for their lands. So there's a reason for their reticence in telling the story. Like, we lost, and that's how badly we lost. The same constitution that Pinochet put in place is still in place in Chile. Not to mention the fact that, of course, in North America, there's a real paranoia of any kind of dissent, right, being labeled terrorism. So for all those reasons and many more, there was a long journey.
Is there fear today on your part?
At this point, I'm kind of over it, but there certainly was during the process,
And fear from what or who?
Oh, people pointing fingers. Like I said, the Constitution in Chile remains the same.
Can you go back to Chile today?
Oh, yes, of course I can go back, yeah.
And when you go back, I mean, is it something that you want to do? Like, I mean, as a vacation and things like that?
I love it. It's fantastic. It's beautiful. I have great family there. Yes, I love it there.
And are you hopeful that it'll change?
No, not at all. I mean, there's an extreme right-wing government in Chile right now, and in fact, the president of Chile was one of Pinochet's economists. No, I don't think much is going to change in Chile in the near future. I'm very, very happy for all the changes that have occurred elsewhere in Latin America. I mean, I think Chile and Colombia are certainly the odd man out at this point. If you compare the governments of Colombia and Chile with the governments in Brazil, Argentina, Bolivia, Ecuador, Uruguay, Paraguay, I'm very happy with what's happening in South America, just not in Chile, per se.
Now, how do you deal with memory in writing this book? I mean, we talked at the beginning of sort of the earliest memories in Chile, the earliest memories in Vancouver. Going back, I mean, where are the memories formed, do you think? Are they because go back in your mind and remember things, or you talk to other people that were there, or they're just there?
I never talked to other people that were there because I wanted to make sure that it was my memoir as opposed to a testimonial of different memories put together, different people's memories put together. I'm very aware, and it is my belief, that all memory is 150% subjective. Mm-hmm. And that's why anybody will tell you that when they get together with their family for Christmas, people start arguing around the table about memories.
Yeah.
About, you know, like, that's not what what are you talking about? That's not what happened. So I purposely did not ask my family what their memories were because I wanted to make sure that it was my completely 150% subjective memory of that story, which my sister would probably have a completely different set of memories that cover that period. So I decided not to, you know, go crazy trying to be objective because that doesn't exist. And I just kept remembering a very famous quote by Jorge Luis Borges, which is, he said later in life, I've come to realize that whenever I recall my childhood in Buenos Aires, I'm not recalling my childhood in Buenos Aires. I'm recalling the last time I recalled my childhood in Buenos Aires. So that's my belief around memory as well.
Yeah. Well, what's the reaction from family members, from your sister, say, or your mom, to the book?
It's been a long journey as well. You know, in order to be an artist, you have to be ruthless, and you have to make art as if your family was dead. I can't quite do that, at least not yet, and I don't know that I would want to. At this point, they're supportive of the book, and like I said, it's been a long journey.
I often ask artists and performers, such as yourself, whenever they're on here on this program, whether they think about their life without the artistic outlets that they have, and you just said that being an artist, you have to be ruthless. Did you ever wonder what you would have done without writing, say, or without performing? Like, what do you think your life would have been like without those outlets?
I would have been a doctor.
Yeah,
that's basically what I would have done. So if I hadn't followed this path, which chose me when I was 3 years old, that's when I remember. Basically, that's when I announced that I was going to be an actor when I was 3 years old, and it was just, that was it. I would have been a doctor, for sure, if I had. Hopefully, I would have been smart enough to get into med school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, you joined the resistance at the age of 18.
Yeah.
We talked at the beginning about your parents, and they were both leftists. I read an article about you, described you as being a revolutionary, that was something that you were destined to be. Do you agree with that idea? I mean, looking back at the arc of your life thus far?
Yes, I agree with that, yes.
Yeah. People reading the book will look at your mom and think that she used her two children as a cover. How do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, although many women did not heed the return plan, that is to say, returned to Chile or to the bordering countries in 79 with their children, many did. And if people pay close enough attention, which I'm sure they will find in the book, and again, don't want to give away huge plot points, that we come across other resistance families who have babies mm-hmm. and who have children. So, obviously, she did not use us as a cover, even though many people might think that. She just really wanted to have to be a mother as well as be in the resistance. And she really felt, as a feminist, that men were not forced to make that choice. And that why should women be treated any different than men? That men would never be asked that question. You know, Che Guevara would never be asked the question of, oh, how dare you have children when you're in the middle of a revolution? So why should women be asked that question? That was the way she looked at it. And she did the best she could. She did everything in her power to keep us safe. And obviously it worked, because here we are. You know, nothing did happen to us in the end. So, I think it also just really illustrates the book, the kind of dilemma that women like my mother faced at that time, and many women faced that dilemma all over Latin America.
Now, you have a son now, I understand?
Yes.
Yeah, how old's your son now?
Four.
What happened to you and what's written in this book? Does he know that yet, or I mean, and when does he know that?
My son?
Yeah.
Oh, well, he's too small.
Yeah, but I mean, at what point do you impart this on to him? The sort of the ideas, the ideals, and the history, and what happened to you?
Oh, as soon as possible. I mean, he's still interested in Curious George, and he likes to watch Diego, which is like our cartoon character.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a friend called Diego, so he thinks that that's Diego. So he's very starstruck by this friend called Diego, because he thinks it's the same guy from the cartoon.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what I'm trying to say is that he's too small to get any of these concepts.
Yeah,
but as soon as he's old enough, I will definitely start telling him these stories, because I think they're important stories to tell.
I mean, at four, you had a very different life yourself, right?
So, yes.
Yeah. Now, I understand there's this play, The Blue Box. That's what it's called, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and that premieres next year,
mm-hmm.
and there's a lot of this book in that. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. How does that work? Is that you wrote it, right? Are you performing in it as well?
Yeah, it's a one-woman show. It's called Blue Box. Coincidentally, a lot of the content from the book is in this play. The play is written in a completely different voice. It's not prose, obviously, because it's
mm-hmm.
a play.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a completely different type of writing. It's direct address, so it's talking directly to the audience. It's a conversational tone. And there's two stories that are woven throughout the play. One that takes place in the mid to late 80s, and one that takes place at the turn of the millennium. And the two stories have seemingly nothing in common, but at the end, one would hope that one is a good enough writer that the audience will go, oh, okay, I think I get it. I think I understand why she's told these two contrasting stories in one play.
You know, you're a great writer, and I don't mean to sound patronizing, but I mean, this book, and this is your first book, it's just a great achievement for a writer. Will you continue writing memoirs? I know you write plays.
Yeah, I think I will continue writing memoirs. I really liked doing it, and I love reading memoirs. I've always loved reading memoirs. Like, it's probably my favorite thing to read, especially memoirs written by writers, right? Like Lillian
yeah.
Hellman, or... You know, Alex Haley, like, I could go on. Yeah. I think I've read every memoir out there. So I enjoy reading them, and I enjoyed writing this one, so I'll probably write more, yeah.
I'll add Karen Connolly to the list, someone who blurbs the book here as a great memoir that she wrote on her life. Carmen, I enjoyed the conversation today. Congratulations again on this book, and good luck with it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. The book is called Something Fierce, Memoirs of a Revolutionary Daughter. It's published by Douglas and McIntyre. Its author, Carmen Aguirre, on the line in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.